Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now going to cover the entire chapter of Genesis, chapter 34, which I will entitle, Dinah is Defiled by Shechem. Now, our context is this. In our previous chapter, Jacob had met Esau and become reconciled to him 20 years before. Remember, Esau wanted to kill him. And Jacob has gone to Haran, Padan Aram. He's gotten his wife, Rachel, after 20 years of servitude with Rachel's brother, Laban. And so he comes out of Padan Aram and goes to the river Jabbok at Peniel, where he wrestles with the angel of the Lord, Jesus, for the blessing. He's wounded in his thigh, if you recall, showing that his flesh is weak. If he wants the blessings from God, his flesh needs to be weak. He moves from Peniel to Succoth, about 5 miles or so toward the Jordan River, where the Jabbok enters the Jordan River, about one-third of the way up from the northern tip of the Dead Sea. And then we're going to see he's going to cross the Jordan River and go just a little bit further on due west and go to Shechem. And that's where we are now in Genesis 34. We start with verses 1, 2, and 3. Now Dinah, the daughter of Leah, whom she had borne to Jacob, went out to visit the daughters of the land. When Shechem, the son of Hamor, now that's Shechem the individual, not Shechem the name of the place, when Shechem, the son of Hamor the Hivite, the prince of the land, saw her, he took her and lay with her by force. He was deeply attracted to Dinah, the daughter of Jacob, and he loved the girl and spoke tenderly to her. Now Dinah, the daughter of Leah, this is the only daughter that Jacob had. She was about 14 or 15 years old, according to Gill and Clark. So she was a young girl, and as I said, it was Jacob's only daughter. That's a terrible thing to happen to your only daughter, to get raped. Now why is Leah mentioned here, the daughter of Leah? She is singled out amongst the two wives and two concubines of Jacob, probably, as John Gill says, to remind the reader that Leah had forced herself into Jacob's bed. I say probably, actually, I don't really believe that. I don't think this is supposed to be some kind of implication or some kind of indication that we need to remember that Leah had forced herself into Jacob's bed ahead of her sister Rachel. And that's not rape. Treachery and fraud maybe, but not rape. The idea here of the commentators who say this is that, hey, Leah got some revenge on her. She got some justice done because her daughter got raped because she had sneaked her way into Jacob's bed. Well, I don't believe that, because sneaking your way into Jacob's bed is not as bad, not nearly as bad as the rape of your daughter. I think the reason that Leah is mentioned here is to account for Simeon and Levi being the leaders in the act of revenge for Dinah's rape that we'll see later, because Simeon and Levi are the blood sons of Leah. So Dinah had gone out to visit the daughters of the land. Josephus speculates that she had probably gone to one of the Shechemites' festivals there, maybe a sheep herding festival or something, and that's reasonable. And that's how she met the pagan Hivites that were living there. Now the land is Shechem. We need to distinguish the land and the person of Shechem. The land of Shechem, it was a city in Samaria. It was also called Sichem. It was in the narrow, sheltered valley between Ebal on the north and Gerizim on the south. I'm picking this out from Easton's dictionary. Ebal is where the curses from on the northern side of the valley came, and Gerizim is where the Israelites had the blessings of the law read to them. Very famous incident, Deuteronomy 28:29. Shechem is also famous because it was here that Abraham first pitched his tent upon arrival in the Promised Land, leaving Haran for the first time when he was 75 years old. That was where, at Shechem, he received the first divine promise. Well, it doesn't actually say at Shechem. It was somewhere between Haran and Shechem. Easton seems to think that Abraham got the promise when he arrived in Shechem, but it doesn't matter. Somewhere he got the promise mainly that he would have descendants as numerous as the dust of the field. Jacob, moving on from Abraham, now we're down to Jacob. He brought a parcel of the field, and that's what we're about to read about. He dug a well there, Jacob did, and that was called Jacob's Well, and of course that was the well at Sichem, or Shechem, where the famous Samaritan woman met Jesus in John chapter 4. She was drawing from that well, and the NIV Study Bible says that well's still there. It's the city of Shechem is now Nablus. Vespasian, the emperor, built it there when the Romans were running Israel, and he called the city Neapolis, the new city, and that got perverted to Nablus, and that's what it's called today. It's in the West Bank, run by the Palestinians, not by the Israeli government. But according to the NIV Study Bible, that well is still there after all these years, which is cool. I wish I could have seen it. I hope the NIV Study Bible commentators weren't snookered by the tour guides there. I'm sure they weren't, because they're scholars. Shechem, during the times of the Mosaic Law, became one of the cities of refuge, the central city of refuge for Western Palestine. Joseph's bones were carried by the Israelites and buried there in Shechem after Joseph had died in Egypt. Rehoboam was appointed king in Shechem, and Jeroboam was afterwards took up his residence there, as we get on later into his Jewish history. So Shechem is quite an interesting historical place. Now the land Shechem, the man Shechem in verse 2 was probably named after the city and not vice versa. I think in a previous audio I had it where the city was named after the man, but probably was vice versa. The man was named after the city according to the NIV Study Bible and John Gill. I don't know how they know that. In verse 2, the man whom Jacob was purchasing the land from, the father of Shechem, was called Hamor. Now Hamor's got an interesting name. Hamor's name in Hebrew means he ass. Isn't that a great name for somebody? He ass. A Hivite from whom Jacob purchased the land where Joseph was afterward buried, according to Eastern. He's called Hamor in Acts 7:16. His son, well, we know all about this. This is what we're going to read about here in just a minute. But the interesting thing that Eastern points out is that his name is he ass. I'm going to call him he ass from now on. He was a Hivite. Well, who were the Hivites? As Easton says, the Hivites were one of the original tribes scattered over Palestine from Hermon to Gibeon. Hermon is the mountain north of Lake Hula, north, which is north of Lake Galilee. Hermon is basically north of the whole land of Israel. As you go into Lebanon, it's right to the west of Damascus, Syria. And Gibeon is down there right around Jerusalem in the tribe of Benjamin. So the Hivites were scattered all over the place, not in one particular place. The name is interpreted as Midlanders or villagers. They were probably a branch of the Hittites. They are mentioned during the conquest of Israel by Joshua. They principally inhabited the northern confines of western Palestine, and a remnant of them still existed in the time of Solomon. Well, that's basically what we know about the Hivites. Now, in verse 2, we read that Shechem lay with Dinah by force. Well, that means by force, that means it's a rape. However, it's not your typical case of rape. Here's what Jameson Fawcett Brown says, quote, "Highly probable that she had been often and freely mixing in the society of the place, and that she, being a simple, inexperienced, and vain young woman, had been flattered by the attentions of the ruler's son. There must have been time and opportunities of acquaintance to produce the strong attachment that Shechem had for her." So this is what I speculate. Since he obviously loved her, as we'll see later on in our text, he must have known her. It wasn't just a random rape where he grabbed some stranger and raped her. He probably basically date raped her. He got to know her, got her in a place where she was by herself. Then he says, "I want you, I love you." And she says, "No, I'm only 14 or 15. I'm a virgin. Things like this are not done in Israel. You need to talk to my father and my brothers. Don't you do this." And he says, "No, I can't stop. Can't stop. Lightning strikes again." And so then he takes her against her will. So in modern parlance, I would say that's a date rape. Now, Jameson Fawcett Brown said that she was simple, inexperienced, and vain. How does he know? How do they know that she was vain? I don't think she was vain. She might have been simple and inexperienced. I'm sure she was. But vain? What's so vain about going to a festival and mixing with the locals and getting to know some women in the area? I think that's entirely unfair to Dinah. It doesn't matter, really, because she was raped. It doesn't matter whether she's vain or not. Now, Shechem loved the girl, loved Dinah, and spoke tenderly to her. Now we see some danger, because if they get married, that means you've got the seed, the sons of the Abrahamic promise, mixing with the pagans, which would, of course, wipe out the love of Yahweh and the people of Yahweh. And so that's danger. Now, why might it have been a tempting thing for the father and brothers of Dinah to agree to such a marriage with Shechem? Well, the girl was raped, but if she gets married to the person who raped her, that takes away some of the shame, and maybe you could say a lot of the shame. Also, Shechem was a prince of the land, so Dinah would have honor and riches. And apparently, Shechem sincerely loved her. That's not often the case after a rape. So there were some temptations here for the marriage to go through, allowed by the family of Jacob. We go to Genesis 34, verse 4. "So Shechem spoke to his father Hamor, he asked, saying, 'Get me this young girl for a wife.'" What did he speak to his father about? Did he tell his father about the whole affair, including the rape? Or did he just say he wanted to marry Dinah? We don't know, and I'm going to speculate as we go through, because I don't know either. Nobody knows. It was logical for Shechem to speak to his father Hamor, because parents often arrange the children's marriages, as the NIV Study Bible says. And when Shechem says, get me this young girl, he means go get Dinah's father's approval so I can marry her, according to the customs of the era. Genesis 34, 5 through 7. Now Jacob heard that he had defiled, that Shechem had defiled Dinah, his daughter, but his sons were with his livestock in the field. So Jacob kept silent until they came in. Jacob's obviously in the home tent there, not in the field. Then Hamor, he asked, the father of Shechem, went out to Jacob to speak with him. Now the sons of Jacob came in from the field when they heard it, and the men were grieved. And they were very angry because he had done a disgraceful thing in Israel by lying with Jacob's daughter. For such a thing ought not to be done. Now how did Jacob hear of the rape? Probably from one of Dinah's maids who had gone to the city with Dinah. They probably ran back to Jacob's tent and said, your daughter Dinah has just been raped. Jacob kept silent about it, though, before his sons came in from the fields. Jacob was not at all acting rashly in the grave circumstances. This is what he didn't do, according to John Gill. He didn't moan and complain to God. He didn't chastise Leah for letting Dinah expose herself to danger. Leah, what kind of a mother are you letting your little teenage girl go wandering around out there amongst these pagans? Now she's gotten herself raped. It's all your fault. He didn't do that. He didn't say, oh, God, why did you let this happen to me? He didn't do that. In fact, he didn't say anything to any member of the family till they could all get together to discuss the issue, which is very wise. You don't make decisions when you're angry. You have to, and you get counsel. He didn't vow revenge on Shechem as soon as he heard it. Now, personally, if I had found out my daughter had gotten raped, I'd have just gone to get the gun and go look for him. And I said, that ain't going to happen. But Jacob didn't do that. He just kept quiet. Now, one reason he might have kept quiet, besides him being wise about it, was that in a polygamous family, it was the duty of brothers to exact justice and not the father. At least that's according to Jameson Fawcett and Brown. I'm not sure that's true or not. I don't know the customs that well. I'm not sure Jameson Fawcett and Brown do either. But it could be it was the duty of the brothers to exact justice, and so Jacob was not the one who had jurisdiction over this case, and so he wanted the brothers to come in. Now, in verse 6, Hamor, he asked, the father of Shechem went to Jacob to speak with Jacob. What was he going to speak about? To try to arrange a marriage? Or was he going to Jacob to say, I'm so sorry my son raped your daughter. I need to make it right with you. Again, we don't know because we don't know whether he asked Hamor knew about the rape. We don't know whether his son told him about the rape. In my opinion, he knew because, I mean, after all, if the word got back from Dinah, who was amongst the Shechemites somehow, if the word got back from Dinah back to Jacob, why would the word not have gotten to Shechem's father? Right there in the area where it happened. I assume he knew. We don't know. But at any rate, he's trying to say, okay, hey, let's marry her off and things will be better. That'll take the shame off the rape. And we can be buddies now. We can be friends. Let's don't get mad. Don't wipe us out. Don't kill us. Well, that's what he was going to try to do. But the problem with that is that Dinah's brothers were extremely upset about this rape. And the brothers threw a monkey wrench into the negotiations with Jacob between he asked Hamor and Jacob. Verse 7, now the sons of Jacob came in from the field when they heard about the rape. Probably a messenger. Jacob sent a messenger out to the field and said, come back here, boys. We got something to talk about. Either he told them about the rape in the message or he said, come back. There's something serious. And then he told the brothers when they got back in from the field, your sister's been raped. The brothers were very angry because Shechem had done a disgraceful thing in Israel. The pronoun in might be translated as against, as the NIV note says. Doesn't matter. I don't think it matters too much. Israel is an anachronistic use of the word, by the way, because the land of Israel is not yet named the land of Israel. The people of Israel were not named Israelites till long after this. In fact, Jacob himself was not named Israel till the next. That's going to happen in the next chapter. So the author of this passage, Moses, is referring to Israelites the way Moses would refer to the Israelites. Again, Moses is about 400 years later. Jacob, I got some dates for Jacob, 1836 B.C. to 1689 B.C. from the Amazing Bible Timeline. Who knows whether they're right or not, but that's a rough time for the Jacob. Moses is 15th century B.C., according to the early date theory, which I hold to. So that's what, 400 years or so later? So Moses just refers to Israel, even though it wasn't named Israel at the time of the story. It was named Israel at the time that the author wrote the text. And the brothers have said that they were grieved because such a thing ought not to be done. That's kind of an understatement. No, it ought not to be done. Somebody raping your sister. No, that ought not to be done. This is the same thing Tamar said when she was raped by Ammon. Ammon is the son of David, if you recall, and Tamar is the daughter. Ammon was half-sister of Tamar, and he raped her. She answered him, 2 Samuel 13:12. She answered him, "No, my brother, my half-brother, do not violate me, for such a thing is not done in Israel. Do not do this disgraceful thing." It's interesting that these rape victims, or the family of the rape victims, they don't talk about the inherent immorality of the act, but about how in Israel it ought not to be done. It's not to be done in Israel, as if it's something different about Israel than everywhere else. I don't know what that means, unless it means that Israel had a higher view of the sanctity of women than people around Israel. I don't know. But at any rate, no, it shouldn't have been done. We go to Genesis 34:8-10. "But Hamor spoke with them," spoke with them, with the brothers, saying, "The soul of my son Shechem longs for your daughter." I say them, it's referring to the brothers and Jacob. "The soul of my son Shechem longs for your daughter, your Jacob's daughter. Please give her to him, give Dinah to Shechem in marriage. Intermarry with us, give your daughters to us, and take our daughters for yourselves. Thus you shall live with us, and the land shall be open before you. Live and trade in it, and acquire property in it, and we'll all live happily ever after." Now Jacob's sons has apparently come in at this point as the father, and later on we'll see Shechem was probably with Hamor, So Hamor and Shechem are there. Now Jacob and his sons are all there. John Gill says apparently the brother's consent was required for marriages back then. I'm not sure that's true. Gill quotes Genesis 24:15 when Abraham's servant, probably Eliezer, is negotiating with Laban about the marriage of Rebekah to Isaac. Genesis 24:50, "Then Laban, who is Rebekah's brother, and Bethuel, Rebekah's father, replied, 'The matter comes from the Lord, so we cannot speak to you, good or bad.'" So the idea here is that Eliezer's negotiating with both of them, the brother and the father, and so therefore we can deduce that there's a custom that brothers have a say in the marriage of their sister. Now, I think that argument is weakened a little bit because Bethuel very well could have been so old here he just couldn't negotiate. He was gone. He was out of it. And so Eliezer had no choice but to negotiate with Laban because the father was out of the picture. So I don't know what the custom was back then, but at any rate, it's obvious that the sons are participating in the negotiation with Jacob about the possible future marriage of Dinah. Now, Hamor, says to Jacob and the brothers, "Intermarry with us." Why would he want to do that? Well, the NIV Study Bible says that Hamor wanted to benefit from the blessings Jacob had received. Remember, Jacob's rich by now, and he's also got a lot of offspring, a lot of sons, a lot of money. Everybody loves rich people. NIV Study Bible points out this is one of the perpetual threats to the people of God. Absorption. The other threat was open hostility. So either hostility or absorption is going to get the Israelites, and God had to constantly protect them from that, from those two dangers. Hamor says, "You shall live with us, Jacob and brothers, and the land shall be open before you." The NIV Study Bible says that Hamor's proposals are open and generous. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says this, quote, "The prince and his son seem at first sight to have acted honestly, and our feelings are enlisted on their side. They betray no jealousy of the powerful shepherds. On the contrary, they show every desire to establish friendly intercourse." Well, that's true, NIV Study Bible. That's true, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. But we need to notice something here. Hamor, didn't apologize for his son raping Dinah. And I'm assuming he knew. Of course, we don't know for sure he knew, but I assume he knew. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says, quote, that there, meaning Hamor and Shechem's, "Their conduct was unjustifiable in neither expressing regret nor restoring Dinah to her family." By the way, Dinah this time is still in the land of the Shechemites somewhere in Shechem. She has not returned to the family. So Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say, quote, "Their conduct, Shechem and Jacob and Hamor's conduct, was unjustifiable in neither expressing regret nor restoring Dinah to her family, and this great error was the true cause of the negotiations ending in so unhappy a manner," as we'll see later. So, yeah, nice proposal, but hey, no apology for the rape. In my humble opinion, that's what Hias should have done. That's what Hamor and Shechem should have done. They should have said, "We're so sorry we did this. My son got carried away." Chapter 34 of Genesis, verses 11 and 12. "Shechem also said to her father and to her brothers," that's Jacob and the 11 brothers, If I, Shechem, find favor in your sight, in your, the brother's sight, then I will give whatever you say to me. Ask me ever so much bridal payment and gift, and I will give according as you say to me. But give me the girl in marriage. So basically saying, what's the price? We want to buy her, the bride price. That's customary. Here we have the first notice of Shechem in the negotiation, so we assume he came with Hamor. Now at this point, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown starts to blame Jacob. Here's what he says. Here's what they say, quote, the consideration of the proposal for marriage belonged to Jacob. Not Jacob and the brothers, or not the brothers, but Jacob. And he certainly showed great weakness in yielding so much to the fiery impetuosity of his sons. The sequel shows the unhappy consequences of that concession. In other words, Jacob should have been a little bit nicer to Hamor than the sons were when they went out and killed Hamor and Shechem. Well, you know, there's a middle ground between yielding to Shechem's query, proposal for marriage, and thus polluting the bloodline of the Abrahamic descent, Abrahamic seed. On one extreme, on the other extreme, is killing Hamor and Shechem. They could have just said, no, we're not going to marry you. Pay us off for the rape. Give us a dowry. We're not going to kill you. We're not going to hurt you, but we're not going to marry you either. That, to me, would have been the proper outcome of this negotiation. But apparently, Jacob couldn't hold off the brothers, especially Simeon and Levi, as we'll see in just a minute, because they ended up killing the whole lot of them. Not only Hamor and Shechem, but all the male relatives of Hamor and Shechem. Now, it might be true that the brothers, as I mentioned earlier, as I think one of my commentators said, that in these polygamous societies, that brothers customarily had more say in such matters than the father did. I find trouble hard to believe that. If that were true, you could say, well, Jacob couldn't help it. The brothers were the ones in charge there. Well, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown said no. The consideration of the proposal for marriage belonged to Jacob, the father, not the brothers. And so he was the one that should have made the deal, not the brothers. He should have stopped this circumcision ruse that they use in a minute in order to cripple the whole male relatives of Shechem so that they could be killed by Jacob's brothers. He should have stopped that, but he didn't. So that does show a little bit of weakness, because he later on got very upset about it. Now, it could be they did it without Jacob knowing about it. That's always possible. So maybe Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown are blaming Jacob just a little bit too much. So Shechem asked for favor from Jacob and the brothers. The favor that he's asking for is, of course, forgiveness for the rape. If you'll forgive me for the rape, I'll give you a bride price as high as you want it. Doesn't matter, I'll pay it. Now, ironically, and not ironically, but as a matter of fact, the later Mosaic law, about 400 years later, handled this sort of situation when a man forced a virgin or seduced a virgin. Exodus 22:16-17. If a man seduces a virgin who is not engaged and lies with her, he must pay a dowry for her to be his wife. That's dowry is really a bride price. Dowry is not technically the correct translation, in my humble opinion. Dowry is when the wife's family pays money to the husband. This is the husband paying money to the wife's family, and so that's a curtsy in legal terms and common law, but a bride price, just to use good English here, a bride price for her to be his wife. If her father absolutely refuses to give her to him, he shall pay money equal to the bride price for virgins. So basically what that means is that if a virgin gets seduced, the father's going to get the dowry anyway, whether the girl gets married to the rapist or not, or to the seducer or not, either way. Or he probably talks to his daughter, you love this guy, or is he a jerk? Oh, he's a jerk. Well, you're not going to marry him. You're going to stay in my household, and I'm still going to take his bride price. So in other words, a rapist was in a bad situation under the law, and I imagine that's probably pretty much the same way it was here. Jacob is going to say, I'll decide whether she's going to marry you or not, but I don't care whether she marries you or not. Whether Dinah marries you or not, you are going to pay me a bride price. Now, that's not stated here, but I wouldn't be surprised if that's what the situation was. In other words, I don't think Hamor is really negotiating from a position of strength here, but he's in love. He wants her. Genesis 34, verses 13 through 17. But Jacob's sons answered to Shechem and his father Hamor with deceit, because he had defiled Dinah, their sister. They, meaning Jacob and the brothers, said to Shechem and Hamor, he asked, we cannot do this thing to give our sister to one who is uncircumcised, for that would be a disgrace to us. Only on this condition will we consent to you, if you will become like us, and that every male of you be circumcised. Then we will give our daughters to you, and we will take your daughters for ourselves, and we will live with you and become one people. But if you will not listen to us to be circumcised, then we will take our daughter and go. Now, Jacob's sons This is total hypocrisy. Well, it says they answered with deceit. Like father, like sons. Remember, Jacob's name means deceit or trickery. Sons must have learned it from their father. I mean, the whole story of Jacob's family is nothing but deceit. He deceives Isaac about his birthright, he and his mother. He deceives Laban about when he's going to run out of town with all of the sheep and so forth. And here he is. His sons are deceiving Hamor and Shechem. They said to them, we cannot do this thing. That's the brothers. It's probably Levi and Simeon speaking for the brothers because they're the ones that are going to take the lead in a few verses later in the murder of Shechem and Hamor. Now, the deceit was this. The brothers said, look, we'll let you marry Dinah, but all of you, every male of you, all of the males in your family must be circumcised. So what they're doing here, they're using a holy ceremony to a murderous purpose. This is a classic example of doing God's will in the flesh. Well, sure, Shechem needed to be punished for what he did, but couldn't the vengeance be done by God and not by this deceitful act here, which is going to result in basically the genocide of a whole city, the mass murder of a whole city? Couldn't God have done a better job of justice? Their justice was not just. It was unjust to kill others for the sin of one man. One man, Shechem, raped the daughter, and they end up killing out the whole lot of them, the whole bunch of the male relatives of Shechem. That was a good thing that they were doing, resisting intermarriage with the Shechemites. That was a good thing, because that would have polluted the promised seed with pagans. But the problem is they resisted intermarriage with the Shechemites in the flesh, using fleshly methods. And that happens all the time, just like with Abraham and Hagar, trying to produce the promised seed in the flesh, Sarah and Abraham, by using Hagar to get a child of the promise, even though it was a child of the flesh and not a child of the promise when Ishmael was born. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown point out that there was no effort here to convert the Shechemites to the true religion. They could have done that. No, they're going to kill them. They're going to trick them and kill them. Now, the brother said it would be disgraceful. It would be a disgrace to us if we let our sister marry someone that's uncircumcised. Now, there was some plausibility to this. Genesis 17:10, which was of part of the covenant, the circumcision covenant, which, of course, the sons of Jacob were a part of. Genesis 17:10 says this, "This is my covenant which you, Abraham, shall keep," God speaking, "between me, God, and you, and your descendants after you, every male among you shall be circumcised." So yeah, every male had to be circumcised in the family of Jacob. But that's talking about males that are already there in the family of Jacob. It says nothing about an uncircumcised man coming into the family. Genesis 17 merely says that if a boy is born, he's circumcised, but it doesn't say anything about an Israelite woman being prohibited to marry an uncircumcised man. However, if you apply that verse and stretch it a little bit, you could say, yeah, and you know, if you're going to come into our family, you need to be circumcised. Because after all, you know, you come into our family, you're bringing uncircumcised people into men into the family. And when you have a child, the child's going to have to be circumcised. So if the child's circumcised, why should the father be circumcised? So there was plausibility in what the brothers are saying here, but it was still done in deceit. Now, there's another thing here that I think is unreasonable about what Simeon and Levi and the brothers are asking for. It would make sense that they would ask that every time an individual Shechemite came into the family of Jacob, that they be circumcised. That's reasonable. But note here, Simeon and Levi and the brothers are asking for mass circumcisions up front. Everybody, you want to get circumcised, whether you're marrying one of our daughters or not. There's only one daughter to marry anyway, it's Dinah, and they're saying all of you be circumcised. So I don't know. That seemed like asking for a lot, but I guess Hamor and Shechem were not in a position of strength in this negotiation. They say, okay, hey, we'll go ahead and get circumcised for you. And the brother said, if you don't do it, we're going to take our daughter and go. This implies that the use of force, because remember, Dinah is now in the purview of the Shechemite somewhere, probably in a house somewhere, maybe even in Shechem's house, where he was either keeping her against her will and violating her or shacking up with her, or maybe he was keeping her in honor. I don't know. But at any rate, they had to get Dinah, and they imply that we're going to take her and get out of here if you don't agree with us. Now, Clark says the Shechemites probably were an inconsiderable force, in other words, weak, because otherwise they would not have sought an alliance with Jacob. And so when the brother said, we're going to take Dinah, they probably very well could have done it, because the Shechemites probably didn't have the power to stop the sons of Jacob from getting Dinah. So now we go to Genesis 34, verses 18 through 23. Now their words, that's Jacob and the brothers, their words seem reasonable to Hamor, Heas, and Shechem. Ahimaaz's son. The young man did not delay to do the thing, i.e. get circumcised, because he was delighted with Jacob's daughter. It was a small thing, slicing the end of my penis so that I can marry the girl that I love. Big deal, that's a small price to pay. Now he, Shechem, was more respected than all the household of his father. He asked, I guess so. He got a name like he asked. How can you respect him? So Hamar, he asked, and his son Shechem came to the gate of their city and spoke to the men of their city, saying, "These men are friendly with us, therefore let them live in the land and trade in it, for behold, the land is large enough for them. Let us take their daughters in marriage and give our daughters to them." So now we've gone to an individual negotiation for one bride, and now we're talking about intermarriage between two tribes, a high-level alliance, if you will. Verse 22, "Only on this condition," Hamar and Shechem continue speaking to the elders at the gate of Shechem, "only on this condition will the men consent to us to live with us to become one people, that every male among us be circumcised as they are circumcised. Will not their livestock and their property and all their animals be ours? Only let us consent to them and they will live with us." Notice that last phrase there, their livestock and their property and their animals. They were greedy, and that's why they wanted this alliance. Now we read in verse 19 that Shechem was more respected than his father Hamor the Heas. Well, I'm not surprised. If I had a father named Heas, I guess I'd be more respected than him too. But remember now, Shechem is a rapist, but he's still respected. Well, it might be because this was not the classic rape. Maybe he seduced the girl when his passion got the best of him, but his superior power over the girl effectively made it a rape. He was at least a seductor, and he took her by force, the scripture says, so he's basically a rapist. But he was still respected by the men of Shechem. Now here's some honorable things Shechem had done. He showed that he loved Dinah. He offered to marry Dinah to protect her reputation. He had dealt fairly and squarely with Jacob, Simeon, and Jacob, and that's true. Now all of his honorable dealings made it easier to get the elders of Shechem to consent to the deal. And I wonder here if Shechem had informed the elders, or Hamor had informed the elders of the city about the rape. If they didn't, then the elders were understandably duped, however, and they were stupid to enter into the alliance if they knew about the rape. But I think they were. They did know about the rape. Given the proclivity of mankind for revenge, they were then allying themselves with somebody that might be pretty upset, a tribe that was pretty upset. But I suspect that it was the property part of the deal that got them. The Shechemites' greed led to their destruction, as the NIV Study Bible says. Remember in verse 23, Hamor and Shechem say, "Will not their livestock and their property and all their animals be ours?" That's probably what got them to go along with the deal, despite the fact of the risk that the Israelites might be offended by what Shechem had done. Well, the NIV Study Bible agrees with this and says the Shechemites' greed led to their destruction. Jameson Fawcett and Brown said that the elders at the gate of Shechem might have gone along with the deal because in the East, despotism was characteristic, and it could be that the elders were rubber-stamping Hamor's decision. Maybe so. But at any rate, they made the deal, and boy, was that a bad decision. We go to Genesis 34, 24, and 25. "All who went out of the gate of his city listened to Hamor and to his son Shechem, and every male was circumcised, all who went out of the gate of his city. Now it came about on the third day when they were in pain that two of Jacob's sons, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brothers, each took his sword and came upon the city unawares and killed every male." Now it says all who went out of the gate, that means they went back to their homes inside the city. The gate, of course, is where all judicial and political matters were settled. Important things were discussed there. They went back and got circumcised, probably thinking, "Hot dog, all I got to do is cut this little skin off my ding-dong, and I'm going to get a lot of money. I'm going to be allied with that rich guy Jacob." It says every male was circumcised in verse 24. That would include the male children as well as the adults. Now, let's talk once again as to how Hamor got the people to go along with his deal. Could be because the people loved Hamor because they respected him so much, or because it was typical Oriental despotism. Hamor was the big shot. But as I said, I think the real reason was the money that was involved in the deal. Now, the Shechemites got themselves killed by Simeon and Levi and friends on the third day of their circumcision. That's the day of the worst pain for flesh wounds. Adam Gill said that Hippocrates, the famous early Greek doctor, physician, Hippocrates advised not to meddle with wounds on the third or the fourth day. So this apparently was well known in ancient times. That's the worst time. Oh, and so Simeon and Levi waited till they were hurting so bad and then killed them where they couldn't stand up and fight back. Now, this murder that was done, and that's what it was murder, Simeon and Levi will punish for it later. Simeon was punished for the murder when Simeon was dispersed all through the tribe of Judah. We read about that in Joshua 19:1. Then the second lot fell to Simeon. This is when Joshua was distributing the land to the patriarchs. And the second lot fell to Simeon, to the tribe of the sons of Simeon, according to their families. And their inheritance was in the midst of the inheritance of the sons of Judah. Now, what that means is they didn't get a contiguous portion of land. They didn't get a tribe, a tribal division. In other words, they just got scattered divisions all through the land of Judah. If you look at a map, you can't find a Simeon on there. The city's just scattered through Judah. We read also 8 verses later in Joshua 19:9, the inheritance of the sons of Simeon was taken from the portion of the sons of Judah, for the share of the sons of Judah was too large for them. So the sons of Simeon received an inheritance in the midst of Judah's inheritance, just scattered throughout the tribe. But they didn't have a tribe of their own. Now, Levi was punished for this murder when Levi was scattered all throughout Israel, also just like Simeon. They lived in 48 towns scattered through Israel, and they had some pasture land surrounding the towns. We read this in several scriptures, Numbers 35:2, command the sons of Israel that they give to the Levites from the inheritance of their possessions cities to live in, and you shall give to the Levites pasture lands around the cities. So the Levites didn't have a tribe either. They just had cities scattered around. Numbers 35:7, all the cities which you shall give to the Levites shall be 48 cities together with their pasture lands. Joshua 14:4, for the sons of Joseph were 2 tribes, Manasseh and Ephraim, and they did not give a portion to the Levites in the land except cities to live in, with their pasture lands for their livestock and for their property. Joshua 21:41, all the cities of the Levites in the midst of the possession of the sons of Israel were 48 cities with their pasture lands. So, no tribal inheritance for Levi. Now, there's a difference in the dispersion of the 2 tribes. Levi was honorably divided in Jacob, as Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say. They got cities scattered around, but it was an honorable thing because Levi was very anti-idolatrous. The Levites were priests, you know, and they didn't like the idols. But the people of Simeon were gross idolaters, and they were ignominiously scattered, according to Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. Now, this punishment on Simeon and Levi was predicted by Jacob when Jacob was dying and blessing the patriarchs in Genesis 49, verses 5, 6, and 7. This is what Jacob said. Simeon and Levi are brothers. Their knives are vicious weapons. He's referring to the knives that sliced up the Shechemites. May I never enter their council. May I never join their assembly. For in their anger they kill men, and on a whim they hamstring oxen. This is again referring to the destruction of the Shechemites and their property. Their anger is cursed, for it is strong, and their fury, for it is cruel. I will disperse them throughout Jacob and scatter them throughout Israel. So, their sins found them out. As the NIV Study Bible says, as serious as Shechem's crime was, as serious as rape is, it certainly did deserve this. The murder of all the male people in Shechem for the seduction and rape committed by one of the Shechemites? Adam Clark says this was an act of unparalleled treachery and cruelty. I agree with that. Now, Simeon and Levi couldn't have killed all the people of Shechem. They probably had people to assist them, probably the other 9 brothers, maybe the servants involved. Or maybe they could have done it if the Shechemites were disabled completely by the circumcision and there weren't that many of them. I don't know. But I'm assuming they had people to help them. Now, Simeon, Levi, and Levi are referred to as Dinah's brothers in verse 25. And that's because they were blood brothers of Dinah, because Leah was their common mother. Now, here I ask, I wonder why Simeon and Levi's blood brothers didn't participate in this massacre. There were some other brothers of Dinah, blood brothers, Leah's sons. In addition to Simeon and Levi, there was Reuben and Judah and Issachar and Zebulun, 4 other brothers that didn't take the lead here. I don't know why Simeon and Levi did it. There's probably no reason. They just did it. Notice in verse 25 that it says that all the males were circumcised. Every male was circumcised. Well, that means every male adult, and that's it, not the children. The male boys were not circumcised. They were carried captive, because we read in verse 29, they captured and looted, they meaning the brothers, the Israelite brothers, captured and looted all their wealth and all their little ones and their wives. So they took the little ones, the kids, and the wives with them. They didn't kill them. We go down to Genesis 34, verses 26 through 29. They, this is Simeon and Levi, and probably the other brothers, they killed Hamor, he asked, and his son Shechem with the edge of the sword, and took Dinah from Shechem's house, and went forth. Jacob's sons came upon the slain and looted the city, because they had defiled their sister. They took their flocks and their herds and their donkeys, and that which was in the city and that which was in the field, and they captured and looted all their wealth and all their little ones and their wives, even all that was in the houses. Well, let's look at the deceased. First of all, is Hamor, he asked, did he deserve death? I don't think so. He didn't commit the rape. Can't convict the father for what the son does. John Gill says, but maybe he connived at the rape and so deserved death. Well, that's a speculation. We don't know that he connived at the rape. There's absolutely no evidence of that. So that was one unjust death. Notice that Dinah was taken from Shechem's house. As John Gill says, Shechem could have been keeping her there chastely as a matter of courtship. Or he could have been carrying on criminal conversation with her, shacking up with her against her will, or maybe with her will. Who knows by now? But at any rate, the brothers got Dinah out of Shechem's house. Jacob's sons came upon the slain and looted the city. That would be the rest of the brothers besides Simeon and Levi. Maybe not Joseph, because he was just a boy, as Jameson Fawcett and Brown says. So here's the result. The Shechemites hypocritically took upon themselves circumcision in order to get wealth, and now they lost what wealth they had. Greed goes before a fall, I suppose. The little ones and the wives were spared, as I said earlier. In verse 29, this was very usual. This was a usual thing to spare children and wives in ancient warfare, and it was also usual to plunder their cities, so this was basically a war. But was it a just war? I don't think so. You don't kill people for rape. Although, well, you don't kill everybody for the rape of one person. Now, I'm not so sure it wasn't just for Shechem to be killed. I've always been of the opinion that a rapist ought to die. But our law doesn't do that. In fact, our law won't even, most of the states in America won't even execute a first-degree murderer, unfortunately. And I suppose there's problems with rape because the problems of evidence is hard to get evidence and so forth. So I realize all that, but just instinctively, I think if a man rapes a woman, the man doesn't deserve to live. And so I don't believe Shechem deserved to live. Verse 30 through 31, then Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, you have brought trouble on me by making me odious among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites and the Perizzites, and my men being few in number, they will gather together against me and attack me, and I will be destroyed, I and my household. But they, Jacob's sons, said, should he treat our sister as a harlot? Now when it says Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, that's sort of flat sounding. He said, I imagine Jacob was very, very upset. So it was more like he screamed at them, he yelled at them, but the scripture's always kind of matter-of-fact about that. Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, and later on Jacob got him, as I've already mentioned, in the time when it was time for him to give his blessings to his kid, Genesis 49:5, Simeon and Levi are brothers, their swords are implements of violence, Genesis 49:7, cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. I will disperse them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. As I've said earlier, that's exactly what happened to Simeon and Levi. Now notice that Jacob's complaint was that he has now been made odious instead of an aggrieved victim whose daughter's been raped. Now Jacob looks like a robber and a murderer. Adam Clark says this sordid blotch on Jacob's good name and the good name of the patriarchs proves the veracity and partiality of the account. You know, most ancient documents have this such and such a king was the greatest guy, the greatest thing since peanut butter. He killed everybody, all the bad guys, and he gave justice and kindness and beneficence to all the good people of the kingdom. And he was just a wonderful person. That's generally how they read, but not in this case. The history is recorded impartially. Some bad stuff that the patriarchs did. Now notice that Jacob did not refer to the immorality of the event, only the bad consequences. Now, you know, if it had been you or me, we would have said, man, how did you do that? How did you kill these people? They didn't rape Dinah. What you did was totally unjust. No. He's thinking pragmatically. Now I'm going to get killed because of what you did. He's not worried about the morality of the situation, which in my opinion, he probably should have been. He's not worried about the immorality of the event. He's only worried about the bad consequences of the event. Now, Jameson Fawcett Brown attempts to rescue Jacob from criticism here by saying that the only way that Jacob could appeal to his sons who were cold-blooded, apathetic, and who had hardened consciences, the only way he could appeal to them was saying, hey, you're in trouble now. He only could use a pragmatic appeal, not a moral appeal, to people who didn't have a moral conscience because of what they did. Or it could be that Jacob himself didn't have a moral sense of the immorality of what happened. I don't know, but it doesn't look good, this pragmatism. Now, Jacob mentions the inhabitants of the land among the Canaanites. The Canaanites refers to all the people in Canaan, as well as a particular tribe of Canaanites. But the Perizzites were one of those particular tribes. The NIV Study Bible says this may refer to rural inhabitants of the land as opposed to city dwellers. Easton's Illustrated Dictionary says the Perizzites were villagers, dwellers in the open country. The Canaanitish nation inhabiting the fertile region south and southwest of Carmel. Carmel is on the northwest portion of Israel, right on the Mediterranean coast, right where that little notch is on the map. And right south and southwest of there would be the Perizzites. They were graziers, farmers, and the peasants of the time. They were to be driven out of the land by the descendants of Abraham, as we read in Genesis and Exodus, various sites. They are afterwards named among the conquered tribes in Joshua. They were still lingering in the time of Solomon, but they were reduced to servitude by then. Now, Jacob is worried about being destroyed. I and my household. Now, think about this. If his household is destroyed, that would be the end of the Abrahamic promises, the land, offspring, and blessing promises that Abraham so famously had received and passed down to Isaac and now it's passed down to Jacob. Now, did Jacob believe that God's promises would fail if his household got wiped out? Well, if you think that he didn't believe that the promise would fail, he was merely saying this to shame his sons. He's saying, my household's going to be wiped out. I don't really believe it's going to get wiped out because I believe in the promises. But I'm going to tell you, my sons, that it will be wiped out so that you can be ashamed of the danger that you've put us all in. Well, there's another option. Yeah, he did believe that God's promises might fail. His emotions got the better of his faith here. This is reasonable. If it not for the providence of God, he would have been wiped out. I don't know what. Or maybe he just didn't think at all. He just lashed out at his son and says, what in the world are you doing? Have you done? What have you done? Now, the sons aren't going to take this lying down. They reply, wait a minute, are you saying that we're supposed to be nice to these guys? They basically raped, they've treated our daughter like a whore, like a harlot. As John Gill says, the brothers are insinuating that Jacob is not protecting the honor of his daughter or his family. So they had a little family quarrel here. Now, let's look at Dinah's participation in this affair. Many commentators say that Dinah ended up treated like this, like a whore, because of her foolish behavior. Proverbs 4:14-15 says, do not enter the path of the wicked and do not proceed in the way of evil men. Avoid it. Do not pass by it. Turn away from it and pass on. So they say that Dinah went out to visit the women of the land, perhaps went to one of their festivals, and so she was in the company of the wicked, the path of the wicked. I think that's extraordinarily unfair to Dinah. Why would she think visiting a festival would result in rape, a sheep shearing festival, or whatever it was she went to? This to me sounds like a classic case of blaming the rape victim for the rape. Now, having said that, I would say it's a matter of prudence for a girl to avoid dangerous situations, but I wouldn't think going to a sheep shearing festival or whatever it was that she went to, I can't think of why you would think you would get raped because of that situation. Now, somehow she ended up being alone with Shechem. Shechem could have easily lured her into a dangerous position where she was alone. After all, she's only 14 or 15 years old. She's innocent, naive. And of course, you should warn your daughters, don't get drunk at a fraternity party. Stay away from those testosterone-laden pagan men who don't give a darn about your mind, your emotions, your character, your spirituality. All they care about is your body. So stay away from them. Carry some tear gas. Be sure to kick them in the crotch if they get too close. And don't let them touch you. No, yeah, you should protect. No, every girl should stay out of danger. There's no question about that. But on the other hand, if a girl puts herself in a compromising position and thus making herself an easy target for rape, the rapist is still 100% guilty because he takes advantage of the situation instead of trying to protect the girl. I remember one time I was at the University of South Carolina. I was coming home to my dorm room, and there was a wild party going on. My dorm was famous for the wildest parties on campus. And I'm getting ready to go into the hall door, and there's a girl lying on the floor drunk out of her mind. I mean, she was unconscious, basically. She was unconscious, which I thought was a dangerous situation. She's just lying on the cement there. So I picked her up and carried her from room to room. There was about, 10 dorm rooms on my floor. And I knocked at one room after the other. Do you know this girl? No. Do you know this girl? And finally, I got around the corner, knocked on the door, and a bunch of drunk students in there. I said, do you know this girl? And this guy drunkenly said, yeah, she's my date. And I said, well, you're really taking care of her. I didn't say that I'm thinking that because I was scared of these people. I was scared they might beat the mud out of me. So I just said, well, here's your date. And I took her and put her on the, laid her on the bed. Now, that girl could easily have gotten raped. I hope she didn't. I didn't ever find out. But no, if she hadn't gotten drunk, so drunk that she was passed out, she wouldn't be in a position where she could have gotten raped. But at any rate, I think it's unfair to say Dinah didn't get drunk at a dorm party. She just went to a festival. Ladies and gentlemen, with that, we will end the story of the rape of Dinah. That prepares us to go to our next audio, which is Genesis 35, which will cover Genesis 35, verses 1 through 15, where God renames Jacob and calls him Israel at Bethel. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.